Thanks for listening to Only a Game. If you love this show, then you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. By supporting your local public radio station, you help us to serve and inform your community. Be informed, be connected, be a part of your public radio. Support public radio by visiting donate.npr.org/onlyagame. Then use the hashtag YourPublicRadio to share why you support independent journalism. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, and this is Imani McGee Stafford.
I grew up in an athletic house, to say the least, so I was always around basketball.
You may have heard of Imani's older brother, two-time NBA champion JaVale McGee, or her mom, WNBA Hall of Famer Pam McGee.
I did theater. I did computers. I definitely thought that I was going to be the one person in my family that didn't play basketball. I was really adamant on it.
Imani ended up in the WNBA anyway. And this is probably a good time to mention that parts of her story are difficult to hear. It includes mentions of sexual abuse and suicide. Here's Only a Game's Matthew Stock.
Imani McGee Stafford says her childhood was confusing. She got good grades. She laughed a lot. But something didn't feel quite right.
If you look at me quickly, you were like, oh, okay, she's fine, she's doing great. But once we have a conversation, like I had a really dark sense of humor, really cynical, really critical. And then you figure out like, oh, maybe something's going on.
Imani's parents divorced when she was 3 years old. She spent her early childhood living with her father, Kevin Stafford.
I was daddy's girl, like umpteenth degree, like on his hip at everything.
When Imani was 8, her dad remarried. One day when she was 10, her 15-year-old stepbrother was babysitting.
And they had said, like, don't leave her alone because I was the nosiest kid ever. And of course, teenage boy goes and starts playing video games, whatever. I had discovered my parents' divorce papers.
Pam McGee's and Kevin Stafford's bitter divorce had been high profile years earlier.
And I like run into my room, sneak it in there. And I just devour it, read the whole thing. And from there, it just kind of went downhill.
Imani's father had argued in court that Pam's WNBA career prevented her from being a good mother. There were allegations of abuse and neglect on both sides.
I don't really know if you ever know how to digest that information, even as an adult. Figuring out that your parents are human and that you may have been hurt or somebody kind of dropped the ball in terms of protecting you as a child. That's hard, especially for a 10-year-old. 10 was actually the first time I tried to commit suicide.
Imani's stepbrother told her father about her suicide attempt, and she started going to therapy. When the family couldn't afford it anymore, she stopped. It would be years before Imani unpacked the full extent of her trauma. Meanwhile, in middle school, Imani found a new lifeline.
I always thought I was going to be a singer, and when I was younger, I actually took it serious. And like I wrote songs. And when we got to 7th, 8th grade English, we started reading The Diary of Anne Frank, Tupac, and I like just discovered the world of poetry and fell in love and immediately like just abandoned music altogether. And poems and poetry just kind of became my thing. Just being angry and sad and being able to write those feelings down was definitely cathartic for me.
Imani started using library computers to watch videos of poets performing their work. She wrote poems about her life and performed them for the first time.
Little did I know, performing poetry at a middle school talent show isn't the coolest thing. And like, I spent the whole year being made fun of because of it. And while it was highly embarrassing, the entire experience kind of gave me more love for the stage.
And having cleared 6'5" as a middle schooler, Imani finally started playing basketball.
Eventually, it made more sense because, you know, not many 6'7" female roles are written, you know, so on one end, it made me kind of feel inadequate or I had this huge like expectation and it sucked. As soon as I walked in the gym, people would ask me how my mom was. It was just kind of a constant reminder of somebody that wasn't there. And then on the other hand, it was kind of my peace. To go in a gym and shut out the world. It didn't matter what was happening, but as soon as I walked in practice, like, I could breathe. None of that stuff mattered.
In high school, Imani developed as a basketball player. Colleges started to recruit her. But then...
We're in class, and I'm taking a psychology class, and we're reading about abuse and the triggers of abuse and what abuse victims look like. And I'm literally seeing myself on the page. habits I have, behaviors I have, things I do. And then on the other side of that, I now have my first boyfriend. And we're talking about sex and like what that looks like in our relationship. And that's when I start having really bad nightmares and night terrors and remembering things. I barely could sleep. And that's kind of the first time I'm like, wow, I think I was sexually abused.
Imani says her abuse started when she was 8 and continued for nearly 5 years.
When you're being abused or going through abuse, if you don't know better, which most kids don't, you think it's normal.
Imani attempted suicide 2 more times in high school. She spent the first 3 weeks of her junior year receiving intense treatment in an institution. But she still didn't tell her father about her sexual abuse. Imani and her dad fought. She was kicked out of the house multiple times.
I started getting high. I started just acting out in every way possible.
By this time, Imani had committed to play college basketball at the University of Texas. But soon, even that was in question.
I'm kicked out of my house. I just got kicked out of school unofficially. And at the same time, Gail Gossencourt, who was the coach that recruited me to Texas, has resigned. So I technically don't have a college scholarship because when it rains, it pours.
Then Imani got a call from Texas's new head coach, Karen Aston.
It was so much easier for her to just say, like, this kid has problems. I'm good. Let me get the next 5-star recruit. And instead, she asked me what was going on, and I told her. I told her about my abuse. I told her I got high. I told her about my suicide attempts, and she just understood. I'll probably never know why she tried and gave me the chance she did, but God, I thank God for her.
Playing basketball at Texas meant a full scholarship, access to mental health resources, and the opportunity to move away from home. Imani graduated from high school in 2012 and joined Karen Aston's team in Austin that fall. If I asked your college teammates what you were like as a freshman, what would they say?
God. They would run you out of here. Man, you don't know how bad this little knuckleheaded 17-year-old that stepped on Texas's university was. I was a naturally smart kid in high school, but I had no study habits whatsoever because I didn't need them. And so my first semester in college, I was like, psh, I don't need tutors. Like, what is this academic resources? Like, I don't need this. I don't need that. And at the end of the semester, I had a 2.7 and it shattered my little heart. And now academics is like, hey, can we help you? Like, let us help you. Like, you don't have to do it alone. And acknowledging that it was okay to ask for help and me needing help didn't make me any less human, any less successful, any less strong, powerful, whatever, was easily the biggest lesson.
And even though Imani says she was stubborn as a mule, her basketball teammates stepped up too.
To be able to have that safety net, that feeling of we love you even when you kind of suck, was new for me. It's the first time I really knew a community or a family, per se, that I felt loved me regardless.
Imani was named Big 12 Rookie of the Year in 2013. And a few weeks after her season ended, she came across information for the Austin International Poetry Festival.
I dragged my boyfriend to it. God bless his heart.
Imani describes slam poetry as competition for artsy folks. Poets read their work, and audience members score them from 1 to 10. She wasn't planning on performing, but an organizer convinced her to get on stage.
I read the poems on my phone, and I get 4th place overall. I started going to slams and open mics and listening to the people who didn't necessarily look like me or come from where I come from express the same emotions that I felt, express the same events or the same things that have happened to me in my life.
Imani added a new part to her routine. After morning classes and 4-hour afternoon practices, she'd rush to different coffee shops and venues around Austin to attend poetry slams.
I found a community in poetry.
The summer after her sophomore year, Imani traveled with the Austin Youth Slam team to a competition in San Francisco. UT Athletics sent a video production team with her to film a short segment for Longhorn Network.
I guess they thought I was going to be talking about, like, rainbows and sunshine. And I'm up there talking about being molested as a child.
It was the first time she directly addressed her abuser in a poem she performed.
Back then, we were the same height. You convinced me that playing house included far more than what Barbie and Ken came equipped with. That if I wanted to be an actress, I was never too young for a sex scene. It wasn't like SVU. I didn't scream. Stabler never came to my rescue. This was normal.
The producer comes up to me and he's like, hey, what are you talking about? Like, are you comfortable, like, talking on camera about what your poetry is about? So I tell him the story and I just tell him everything.
Because I'm a suicide survivor. I'm a molestation survivor. Like, I've done this, you know what I mean?
And I think what Imani didn't know is that Longhorn Network is owned by ESPN. So when the segment was finished, ESPN was the first to see it.
They like it, they bump it. And like, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And now they're running this story during March Madness on SportsCenter prime time on ESPN, and I'm freaking out. And the first thing I was scared. People I grew up with didn't know this. Like, my grandmother found out stuff on that special that she didn't know.
You will become addicted to television, to families that look so different than your own. You will envy the parent-child relationships, the way the parents are so approachable.
And I just felt very naked. But then the craziest thing happened. So many people reached out to me and they were like, we support you, or we're so proud of you, or we're so sorry you went through this. My teammate, her mother came up to me like bawling, like, you just told my story and I've never told anybody like in my life.
Other people shared similar experiences.
That kind of changed the trajectory of my life.
Imani just finished her second season in the WNBA. She sees her therapist when she needs to, keeps a daily prayer journal, and writes poetry.
I just wrote a poem the other day. It's my happy place.
Imani says that by being unashamed about her journey, she's been able to live the life she wants to. This past summer, she published her first book of poetry and held a book signing.
All of my teammates on the Dream showed up and purchased a book. I was so freaked out, and my coaches came and they all took pictures and posted about it and bought a book. And I was like, I was such a big sap at the end of the day. Like, they couldn't see it, but like when I went home, I like cried happy tears. As much as I would like to think that I'm the next poet savant, it's really just because I play basketball and it's different for people to be both athlete and artist. Not all of us are given the platform to do both, the ability to do both, or the courage to do both.
How did basketball make you feel, and how did poetry make you feel?
I consider poetry air. It was my way to exhale, my way to express things that I didn't know how to say. While basketball was confidence, it was the ability to feel like I was bigger than whatever I was going through. When I made a free throw or got a good block or rebound, whatever, I just felt so much bigger than whatever was trying to kill me. I guess I'm a poet first, but I think like poet is who I am and basketball is what I do.
That's Imani McGee Stafford. Thanks to Only Game's Matthew Stock for this story. If you or somebody you know are in crisis, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
This week on Ask Me Another, we hit the stage in sunny San Diego, California, with American Idol alum Adam Lambert and skateboarding legend Tony Hawk. All this on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. For those of you pretending to be too cool to know, that's the band Maroon 5. They will reportedly be performing at February's Super Bowl halftime show, unless some petitioners have their way. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Bleacher Report's Miran Fader and The Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Karen. Karen.
Rihanna, Cardi B, Mary J. Blige, Andre 3000. These are just some of the artists reportedly asked to perform at the 2018 Super Bowl halftime show. All of them, and possibly many, many more, are said to have turned down the opportunity to perform for 100 million people because they want instead to show their support of Colin Kaepernick. And I say, good on them. Maroon 5 said they would perform, and just this week, rapper Travis Scott said yes, too. A petition is going around trying to persuade Maroon 5 to change their minds. None other than Jay-Z is reported to be pressuring Travis Scott to back out. This week, the New Yorker asked, quote, "Is it hypocritical, a kind of lame tacit endorsement for Maroon 5 or any left-leaning artist to appear on the show?" No. There are many ways to protest. There are many ways to make your voice heard. And I do think it's possible to perform at the Super Bowl halftime show and still be a good person. Jason?
Yeah, it sounds good to me, Karen. Look, you know, I don't know what this highfalutin piece is all about. I know this is just a big ruse for you to play some Maroon 5 on Only a Game. And you finally got it done after years and years of trying. You know, this is what the NFL specializes in, this halftime show, right? Is naming an act that has no discernible connection to the city, to the moment. I think the most offensive part of Maroon 5's selection here is the fact that they passed over what is inarguably one of the greatest musical cultures in the world, didn't name an Atlanta act at a time when Atlanta acts are dominating the charts globally. That was a very strange move, and I think you wouldn't have had the kind of like backlash to the backlash to the backlash that we're currently experiencing. You know, you feel for Maroon 5 a little bit here, right? It used to be this real marker of your cultural importance to be the Super Bowl halftime show, and now it's just a feel-bad social media scream fest like everything else.
You know, I'm kind of looking at it a bit differently. I agree it should have been an Atlanta act for sure, but I think if Maroon 5 is going to posit itself as this, you know, really left-leaning, progressive group, I really think they should stand in solidarity with Rihanna, Jay-Z, Cardi B, all the other artists who have boycotted. I think it's not enough to say that you support dismantling systemic racism and police brutality, all the things that Kaepernick is kneeling for. I think it takes an action, and I think that performing is kind of, it is kind of a tacit endorsement, and if they really want to show solidarity, I think it will mean giving up something as huge as this, but I think that would be a testament to, I guess, how committed they are to the cause.
Yeah, that's a really good point. But I still can't shake the idea that I've got in my head of the big finale, you know, fireworks and all of that, and then they all rip off their jackets and they're hiding free cap shirts underneath or something. I mean, if they're going to perform, I hope they do something with it. Miriam, what do you have for us this week?
I wrote a story for Bleacher Report on Andrea Yearwood. She's a 17-year-old transgender black girl in Connecticut, very small town, Cromwell. And there's a petition out there to prevent her from running in the girls' division, which she's allowed to per Connecticut state policy. They allow you to run in the division with the gender you identify with. But a lot of people are angry about it. A lot of people think that she has a biological advantage. They think she's cheating, taking away scholarships from cisgender girls, even though there's no evidence of that. So I really think this is an important story. It really raises the ultimate question, what is fairness and who ultimately gets to experience fairness?
My question is, how does she feel about this? I mean, I think it's hard enough to be a teenager, you know, to be competitive in sports in high school can be a real pressure cooker. How does she feel about the fact that, in addition to the fact that she wants to compete, there's this whole other thing that's happening around her?
I mean, she's absolutely stunned at the lengths that people have gone to stop her from running. There was a formal petition, you know, signed by many of the rival coaches in her area, people she's shaken hands with, parents that she, you know, they basically scream insults at her from the stands. And so it's very hard to be her, and not just a transgender girl, but a black transgender girl. You know, 21 of the 26 transgender individuals murdered this year were women of color. So she's dealing with so many things that go beyond, you know, should she be able to compete?
I always find myself in these situations understanding the people who are concerned, because these issues are complicated. I do get it. Having more testosterone does make you stronger. But I'm reminded of like Castor Semenya and Dooty Chand, who were both born cis women. But when they started to dominate their sports, they were told that they naturally produced too much testosterone. They were told that they weren't women enough. The same thing that's being said to Andrea here. But what's sticking with me is this idea that there is no level playing field when it comes to sports. Every super successful athlete has some sort of genetic advantage. You know, like nobody tells LeBron James, you're too tall to play basketball. Nobody tells my nephew, who's 6'5" and in middle school, that he's too tall to play with middle schoolers and he should play with high schoolers instead.
Wait. Can we just stop there for
a
second?
Yeah.
You have a 6'5" nephew.
He might be 6'6". I haven't seen him for 2 weeks.
Has he committed to anybody yet?
You know what? He's not even the best player on his team. And Andrea isn't the best runner in the world. Like, these genetic advantages don't mean everything, right? And there are disadvantages that come along with them.
I mean, I think that's a critical point. She doesn't dominate. Her times for the 100 are just outside of major university marks. So the vitriol that she faces is very much not exactly rooted in winning an opportunity, but just in the plain fact that she is a transgender girl. I think it's so helpful to remember that we're talking about high school kids. You know, a lot of angry comments were like, it's like throwing LeBron James in the WNBA. And it's very important to remember, like, no, that's not what we're talking about here.
I'm always interested in kind of the esoteric, soulful question of why runners run, and why do you think she is so compelled to do this?
I love that question. It's a feeling that she gets, and every runner, every athlete knows. You just feel kind of free. You get this high. And what I think is interesting about her is that she loves to run, but it's not her sole passion. She knows 13 languages. I mean, who among us knows 13 languages? So, you know, it's just something that she feels like, hey, if I want to use this bathroom, I should be able to use this bathroom. And if I want to compete in track, I should be able to compete in track. You know, it's about her being able to live the life that she wants to.
Jason, you're up.
Well, you know I love the geezers, Karen. You know, I'm approaching geezerhood myself. And nothing makes me happier than a senior elite athlete. And boy, do I have one for you guys this week. Jean Dykes, a 70-year-old retired computer programmer from Philly, used to golf. Used to garden, likes to do, you know, average retiree things, but also is a world-class distance runner to the point that last Saturday in Jacksonville, Jean shattered a record people never thought would be broken, a record by a guy named Ed Whitlock for the 70-year-old marathon time. 2:54.23. That is a pace of 6 minutes, 39 seconds per mile. Absolutely astonishing. And the great thing about Gene, who I got to spend some time talking to about this week, he didn't know he had this in him. It really, you know, he ran a little bit of track in high school, did a little bit in college by his own admission, was not a star, and, you know, truly jogged through most of his professional and family life. But it wasn't until about 5 years ago that he got serious. He hired himself a coach. His ascension has been astonishing. He's just my favorite new American athlete right now.
I love the guy's attitude, and I hope to God that I'm as fit at 70.
Or at 60.
At 60. Yeah, really at 50. Honestly, I think it's one of those people that we're all rooting for. He didn't strength train, I think you said in there, and he didn't.
No so fad just, diets, eats junk food. I mean, I love the guy. He's
it.
Me.
Yeah. He's the everyman.
You know, I always love it when I'm running one of those little road races and I get lapped by an 80-year-old. That always makes me feel so good. But, you know, Jason, this story reminded me of, I did a story about this woman named Pat Glantrette earlier this year. And she's a marathon swimmer, and she set all sorts of records for being like the oldest woman to swim the English Channel and that sort of thing. And she started marathon swimming when she was 46. I talked to her and I thought, wow. There's still time for me to find my like record breaking sport.
Everybody loves a late bloomer, Karen, and I'm still waiting to late bloom.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Bleacher Report's Miran Fader and The Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Basketball basketball fans of a certain age will recognize these names from the late 90s through the mid-2000s, and one mixtapes were big. Famous streetballers with names like The Pharmacist and Hot Sauce were filmed playing on blacktops and in gyms around the world. Highlights of their alley-oop dunks, slick dribble moves, and no-look passes were mixed to music, broadcast on ESPN, and sold as VHS tapes and eventually DVDs.
Rebound comes down. It's almost stolen away, and it is stolen away. This is sick. Win it! Today. Get it! No relation.
But within a few years, it was all over. Reporter Olivia Christian brings us the story of how this all began and how its legacy carries on today.
DJ Set Free, or Set as he's commonly known, first found hip-hop when he was about 10. He remembers sitting on a sidewalk in Queens, listening to Eric B. and Rakim.
And I was like, yo, this is cool. And like the way he was rapping over a beat and like kind of telling the story and telling where he was from.
I ain't no joke. I used to let the mic smoke. Now I slam it when I'm gonna make sure it's broke. When I'm going,
it was like learning in a different way about a person and a place over a beat.
As a child, Set split his time between New York and Philly.
I remember in Philadelphia was like one of the, like, it's a spot called The Now. It was like a swim club, and you had the generator hooked up to the turntables and the big speakers. You just see people in their cars, pulling over, jumping out of cars, running to celebrate music, just to, you know, dance and have fun. And you got girls jumping rope, and now they're jumping rope to the beat. You got the family cooking out on the grill, and then, like, you see the family dancing to it. Then you see the same DJs pulling up to the basketball court. Now they're on the court, the guys are dancing on the court to the music.
Back in New York, Set was DJing house parties, perfecting his craft, when he was hired to work in the marketing department at And One, a shoe and apparel company for players and fans of basketball. The company got its name from the game itself.
Catch and shoot, oh, And dude. One! Oh, fouled, And One, a four-point play! Count it, And One!
And that brings us to late 1998.
I was at work. I was working at And One, and a guy who was head of marketing named Jeffrey Smith told me, come in my office, I want to show you something. Pulled me in the office and showed me just VHS tapes of basketball footage.
What Set saw was grainy footage of streetballers, basketball players, that ruled their neighborhood blacktops. These players had swag. Their dunks, their stutter steps, their ankle-breaking crossovers had crowds roaring.
I came back to work the next day, and I said, Jeff, can I take these tapes home? And he said, yeah, you can take them for what? I said, I don't know, I just want to take them home, watch them, chill out, watch tapes.
Set had a TV hanging above his turntables. He often watched movies with the sound down while he DJed. But this time, he put on one of those VHS tapes.
And I'll never forget that, like, the kick drum matched up to a dunk. And the snare matched up to a jump shot. And I said, wow. And now I was just practicing matching the beat to the basketball. And that moment I said, I got something special. I didn't even go to bed probably till like 4 o'clock. And I was so excited to go back into work. And I went back into work and I just remember telling Jeffrey Smith, I said, you gotta put me in the studio. And that's like how the creation happened.
And One sent Set down to Florida to a studio. He synchronized beats, layered tracks, and tried to develop this into a legit mixtape. Then he jumped into the recording booth and started calling out song titles and artist names.
Hey, yo, with that new genius. Break the mic up.
We had one song combined to video footage, and we mailed out copies, FedExed them to rappers' houses. And I said, hey, I'm gonna send you this FedEx tomorrow. And then I'm going to call you, and I want you to describe what you see. And I remember, like, calling Common, and he was like, man, these And One mixtapes are incredible. This is crazy. And I remember calling Sway.
Hey, yo, check this out. This is Sway from the world-famous Wake Up Show with King Tech and DJ Revolution. And y'all about to beauty.
Yo, man, come on now. What could be better than this thing right here? And One. Okay. See y'all.
So are people really giving it honest feedback and honest thoughts of what they thought about it? And that's when I knew, I was like, now it feels like a mixtape.
The mixtapes were sent off to representatives at the hip-hop record labels Tommy Boy and Ruckus Records.
And the Street Teams, which was big back in the late 90s, they took the VHS tapes to all the clubs, they took them to all the basketball courts, they took them to studios. You know, everybody was doing mixtapes on cassette or CD, and I just made a strong left turn and made a VHS mixtape. So it was overwhelming, from athletes, street ballers, DJs, record labels, record companies, and then just the fans of music, fans of sports, to say, yo, this was something the illest I ever seen. It was just a great fulfillment.
Over the next several months, copies started showing up everywhere. Those tapes were sometimes called the Skip Tapes. They featured Rafer Skip to My Lou Alston, who went on to play 11 seasons in the NBA. They also featured Wally Dixon.
Main Event.
Shane Wooney.
Shane the Dribbling Machine.
Anthony Hayward.
Half Man, Half Amazing.
Malloy Naismith.
Future.
And Crafton Ferguson.
Aircraft.
These street ballers were known around their neighborhood as having game, commanding crowds that were drawn in by their style of play and their on-court personalities. Now, they were getting calls from across the country, but they hadn't been compensated for their first appearance, so Set wanted to make things right.
We was the Sonotapes, but now we're showing these people likeness, and we, you know, we was benefiting as a brand off the momentum. So it was like we had to go back and find these players and figure out what we could do and how we could work with them.
These guys, playing for the love of the sport, were now jumping into a whole new game, unplanned and unprepared for where it would take them. Eventually, they agreed to start throwing events, first in New Jersey. From there, the tour expanded to Philly, New York, Atlanta, L.A., and Chicago.
It was just an aha moment in sports and culture where it was like, hey, you can be here just playing ball, or you can go all around the world, play basketball, get paid, get clothes, and you know, I don't think it was anything to turn down.
The N1 mixtapes took off, and so did the up-and-coming hip-hop artists who supplied the soundtrack. The tour was a showcase for the brand's biggest stars and an opportunity for street ballers to have their artistry documented and shown to audiences around the world.
They were just all stars in their own realm, you know, being from the hood, of the hood, with the hood, still playing in the hood. And, you know, then it started turning around where the NBA players seen the mixtapes and was like, we seen some of the greatness you did out there on that court. So they started gaining fans from the hardwood.
Up until the late 90s, the NBA was a little buttoned up. Most shorts were still fitted and laid above the knee. Arms and necks weren't completely covered in tattoos. But that was changing, and big media brands started taking notice.
I remember watching the ESPN game, and the announcer was like, hey, they're out there doing that N1 stuff. They're doing that mixtape stuff.
Players like Rasheed Wallace, Allen Iverson, and Jason Williams were making a mark on the NBA. Their attitude, their swagger, was just different than the players that preceded them. The no-look passes and finger rolls from a generation ago sounded like jazz. But this new crop of players, they sounded different. With players coming up in the league that were born and raised in this culture, hip-hop became the new soundtrack of basketball. And with the culture becoming more and more mainstream, basketball became the soundtrack of hip-hop.
I think the N1 mixtape had an influence on the world. It was a magnifying glass for a lot of different cultures to be shown.
Were you ever concerned about whether or not that culture would be exploited, taken advantage of, copied, watered down?
Everybody's not going to go in the mine to find a diamond. And what I mean by that is that brands and companies, they don't want to go to the part where nobody goes. You know, in the 90s, the playground shootings was at an all-time high. You know, nobody really wanted to go to the playground from corporate world. At nighttime, daytime. And we went somewhere where the people wasn't going. And that's where I felt like it could never be exploited.
And One stopped producing mixtapes in 2008. In the summer of 2018, 20 years after the release of the first mixtape, DJ Set Free opened the Compound Gallery in the South Bronx. It's a place where some of the biggest names in art, culture, hip-hop, and basketball gather. The influence of the mixtapes on the NBA, college hoops, streetballers, all of them, as well as art, music, and fashion, this collision of culture, it's evident. When you watch NBA All-Star Weekend and see who's lining those first three rows, you know it. And when Kevin Durant, Chris Rock, and Mos Def are all dropping by the compound to holler at Set, you know they know it too.
That's reporter Olivia Christian. In 1947, Babe Ruth was dying of cancer, but he put on a brave front to make dozens of polio patients happy.
This was a man who, given how he had been abandoned, was not going to abandon little kids.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Only a Game listeners, have you supported your local public radio station yet? Now's the time. Go to donate.npr.org/onlyagame. Then use the hashtag #YourPublicRadio to show why you support independent journalism. I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, I'm going to use the phrase sticky wicket a whole bunch of times as we meet athletes who've made the best out of difficult circumstances. But now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
I thought we were doing our annual cricket special.
On Monday night, Carolina Panthers safety Eric Reed was subjected to a random drug test. It's the sixth random test he's been subjected to since rejoining the league in September. And a lot of people are saying that's mighty suspicious. Would you like to explain why?
Well, because the probability of being selected randomly for drug testing when the league just happens to have a grudge against you anyway are pretty long. This has now become absurd, and I congratulate Eric Reed for pointing out how absurd it's becoming.
Yeah, just to be clear, Reed was, of course, the first player to join Colin Kaepernick in his protests, and he has also filed a collusion lawsuit against the league in May, and that's ongoing. So this does seem to be motive.
Yeah, it looks like part of the discovery procedure for that lawsuit, rather than any kind of, you know, health benefit or safety regards.
Well, the mathematicians have spoken. There's a 0.17% chance that one would randomly be tested six times in 11 weeks. And that's roughly similar to the chance you have to flip heads nine times in a row. So yep. Clearly random.
Absolutely. No question here. I'll just flip this coin nine times and see how often it comes up heads.
Many promising and exciting high schoolers committed to college football teams this week, Charlie. And I don't want to talk about one of them. I want to talk about the tragic situation that's going on with fax machines.
Yeah, the traditional dinging of the fax machine as you fax in your national letter of intent is, of course, gone because everything happens in cyberspace now. It's enormously tragic. I expect that at the College Football Hall of Fame in Atlanta, Georgia, which I walked by last weekend without going in, there will one day be a fax machine exhibit.
Apparently in 2017, Rice University saw 15 of its 18 signees file digitally rather than by fax, which just really makes me impressed at those other three who actually were able to find a fax machine to send in their letters of intent.
Yeah, they live upstairs from an old-fashioned one-person copy shop, I think. But I felt there was something really poignant in what Rice coach David Bailiff told the Houston Chronicle about the old method of finding out you'd landed a player. Yeah, he said, you used to huddle by that fax machine. You didn't know what was coming next. All the mystery is going out of life. What can I tell you? And I just like the idea of the coaching staff doing a bonding exercise, huddling around the fax machine like ancient man around a fire.
Well, the dot matrix printer just slowly.
Right.
On Tuesday, Brooklyn Nets center Jarrett Allen blocked a dunk. That's his job. He's a shot blocker. So why is this news?
Because he blocked LeBron James, and he did so on video that was captured and sent around the world on the magic internet, not by fax machine, I might add. And then LeBron James got a little salty.
He did.
In response, yes.
Well, you really can't blame him. He's gone up for a dunk 1,850 times in his NBA career, and he's only been blocked nine times. Nine.
That's like the kind of odds Eric Reed's drug test was was facing. But it was a great block, by the way. It's, you know, if Jared Allen does nothing else in his pro basketball career, he'll have that moment to look back on.
Remember in September when New York Yankees pitcher CC Sabathia was ejected from a game, leaving him just six outs shy of a $500,000 performance bonus? Well, guess what?
Oh, do you want me to guess?
Yeah.
He got the bonus anyway. And the great thing was he got thrown out for hitting a guy.
Yeah.
Which was tremendous. And now hitting Jesus Sucre has earned him a half a mil.
Well, Sabathia says the 2019 season will be his last. Are you looking forward to the goodbye tour?
I think it'll be interesting. He's an interesting character because, I mean, visibly he's never in shape, but he's still a terrific pitcher.
And finally, Charlie, we must speak of the teddy bear toss at a recent game between the Sheffield Steelers and the Coventry Blaze of the UK's Elite Ice Hockey League.
Westerling scored, but it won't count. Whoa. Hold those bears. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, it's the they didn't hold those bears, did
they? They did not, no. And the reason the goal didn't count is because the goalie made an unbelievable
incredible
stick save
yeah
behind him before the puck went over the line. That was visible, you know, to the viewers of the UK Elite Ice Hockey League, which I did not know existed prior to this morning. It wasn't visible to them until the replays. The people in the crowd didn't care. They just started throwing bears, including one guy who threw a bear the size of a small refrigerator and got it over the boards and over the glass. And congratulations to him.
Well, the play-by-play announcer was left with quite a dilemma. Here it is.
Even though,
what shall I do with the teddy bear that is in my left hand right now?
So what would you
do? I have an answer you can't use on television. You got to throw the bear. I mean, if everyone around you is throwing the bear, you have to throw the bear.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen, and Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to all our listeners.
Absolutely. In 1902, 7-year-old George Herman Ruth was sent away to St. Mary's Industrial School for Boys.
The little boy his family called Little George, they abandoned to the reform school on the far western edge of Baltimore City.
That's writer Jane Levy.
And these boys slept head to toe. They bathed together. They ate together. They played baseball together. So what Babe Ruth learned was not just to throw and hit a baseball, but he learned to be public. That's where he is most exquisitely happy and most himself.
This story is about one of those public appearances, very near to the end of Babe Ruth's life, at Christmas time. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Babe Ruth was celebrated as few American athletes have ever been, and he loved it. But a lot changed when his playing days ended in 1935.
He had nothing to do.
Ruth wanted to manage a team. He had a brief stint as the first base coach of the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1938. But other than that, he received no job offers from major league clubs.
His wife said he was suicidal. He would sit by the window and wait for the phone to ring.
During the last 13 years of his life, Ruth experienced the same feeling of rejection he had felt as a young boy.
His life was pretty much empty, except for these little events that he got summoned to where he remembered who he was.
Those little events were often visits to children in orphanages and sick wards. He did that for years. But then, in 1946, Babe Ruth was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer.
And the cancer was growing in a place way back behind his sinus passages where it was inoperable. He was in excruciating pain. His left eye was shut. He was on intravenous medication. It hurt to talk, and his head was killing him.
But in late 1947, Ruth got an invitation he couldn't refuse.
It was an event where he would play Santa Claus at the Hotel Astor in Manhattan for a group of kids who had been treated with a specific regimen for polio.
At first, no one had any idea who was behind the white beard. Reporters and newsreel film crews were careful not to give away the surprise. Ruth managed to conceal his identity and his discomfort.
He was in such incredible pain. And by this point, his face was caved in. He was emaciated. He had lost a ton of weight. His speaking voice is like sandpaper on a bad piece of wood.
Here's 7-year-old Tom Gidera, captured in newsreel footage, making his request to Santa / Babe Ruth.
I want a rabbit.
You want a rabbit?
Yeah.
But why a rabbit?
To this day, I can't tell you the answer.
That's Tom Gidera, now 78 years old. In 1947, he was undergoing a controversial polio treatment called the Sister Kenny Method.
They take small pieces of blanket, put those in hot water, and put them on the affected muscles for about 15 minutes. That is followed by a stretching of that particular limb or muscle until you scream.
Babe as Santa did his best to help Tom and the other kids forget about things like that. But there were no rabbits on hand at the Hotel Astor, so he had to improvise.
Oh, now, how can I get a rabbit? Well, I don't know about a rabbit, but I'll give you one of these nice shoes until we get a rabbit for you.
Okay. Ruth called the toy he gave Gadara a choo-choo, but that's not what it looks like.
He gave me a stamped metal car, if I remember correctly. And I took that and I said thank you to him and walked away.
In the newsreel, as Gadara walks away and the next child arrives, Ruth drops his jolly facade for a moment. He repeatedly pushes his sagging Santa beard back on.
These whiskers are getting me down.
These whiskers are getting me down, Ruth says.
His face had caved in so much from the illness. His face was too small. He couldn't hold them up anymore. That broke my heart.
Ruth talked with and gave presents to each of the 65 kids at the event, including one little girl with an unusual request.
You want a baby brother? Oh, now, baby brother.
The old babe would have had a quick rejoinder. He would have said something funny. You know, turn to the adults behind him and say, yeah, I'll take care of that. But there was none of that left for him. He can't think about anything other than staying alive.
Babe Ruth lived for another 8 months. He died on August 16th, 1948. Back in 1947, Tom Gadara didn't know who Babe Ruth was. When he was a bit older, he learned about Ruth's accomplishments on the baseball diamond. And in 2000, his wife brought home a DVD that included the newsreel footage you've been hearing. He hadn't known it existed. And it was then that Gadara began to fully appreciate who Ruth really was.
When I finally realized the pain he was in, it had an impact. How could a guy in that kind of pain take time to minister, if you will, to kids that were sick? That seemed tremendous to me.
I think Babe Ruth needed more than anything to be needed and to be wanted. I think that kids like this completed him, and they needed him. And this was a man who, given where he had come from, given how he had been abandoned, was not going to abandon little kids.
But there's more to the story. In 1947, Ruth agreed to be an anonymous guinea pig for the experimental cancer medicine teropterin. It didn't save Ruth's life, but it did save others. And it led to more effective medicines that would save thousands more.
This is the most important thing he's ever done. To save this many lives, that's a hell of a legacy.
At the end of the Hotel Astor party on December 10th, 1947, Babe Ruth bestowed a wish upon everyone gathered there and a few more people besides.
I want to take this opportunity to wish all the children, not only in America, but all over the world, a very Merry Christmas.
Well said, Babe. That story was from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Jane Levy's new book is The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. Our final word comes from Jane Levy, who speculates on what Tom Gadara's gift from Babe Ruth would be worth today, if he had held on to it.
It'd be $1 million choo-choo.
Now that would be a happy holiday. I'm Karen Gibbon, and happy holidays from all of us here at Only a Game. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.